My name is Jeff Lerner, and I interview elite performers from a wide range of disciplines, entrepreneurs, athletes, celebrities, scientists, artists, and more. This is Unlock Your Potential. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Unlock Your Potential. Jeff Lerner, your host, always thrilled to be back with you, having amazing conversations with amazing human beings. Today, we are joined by Andrew Bustamante, who I guess time will tell how amazing he is, but I definitely know he's interesting and mysterious and, dare I say, an international man of mystery, but like less cheesy than the cliche of that. He's a former CIA officer, runs a program called Everyday Spy, program called Spy Hacks, former covert CIA intelligence officer, who's also married to a former CIA intelligence officer, which is probably his most challenging assignment ever. U.S. Air Force combat veteran, does a lot of corporate advising for Fortune 5, 10, 50, 100, 500 type companies, and on and on and on. We could take an hour and just read his bio, or we could talk to the man. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Thanks for having me. And I appreciate your whole time will tell whether or not we're amazing. I feel like that's the thing that we all have to keep in mind. We all have to stay humble because you never know what time and what history will say about you.
Well, I've been listening. I've been doing my homework, listening to interviews about what do they call it? Tradecraft.
Tradecraft. Right? Like, that's right, man.
About, and so I'm like, ooh, well, I'm going to have to make my own judgment because I'm pretty sure that Andrew could pretend to be any human that he wanted. So, but no, I'm being kind of snarky. Like, I actually appreciated how really down to earth you come across in your conversations, being a real life embodiment of so many Hollywood cliches. It was nice to just hear from a man. But anyway, welcome to the show. I'm a little torn on even where to start. I feel like the audience is probably salivating. They want all the like they want to hear as much as you can share that sounds like it could come out of a James Bond movie, I'm sure. And I'm interested in those things too. But what I really fancy this show to be about and that makes it a little different is like I'm really, really interested in the man, the human, the story, the little boy with stars in his eyes who grew up to be something that to some degree did or did not comport with the stars in his eyes. And that's what's really interesting to me. So maybe we can start there. And I guess, how does one become... Well, actually, before I ask, how does one become a CIA spy? How does one become a person that could become a CIA spy, right? Like, walk me back to the beginning. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's actually the better of all the questions that we could have started with. So let me kind of kick off by saying that what Hollywood does to portray CIA officers is completely wrong. And then I'm sure that surprises everyone exactly 0%. But just like when you watch a show about ER surgeons, everything's wrong. When you watch a show about how police carry out their job, everything's wrong, right? There's an element of creative license that has to be used to turn it into entertainment. Entertainment and education could not be more different, right? And what I'm all about is spy education. So the real facts about how CIA officers work are far more pragmatic and practical than anything you've ever seen in a Hollywood movie. I often tell people that I think Hollywood gets it wrong because they miss the best parts of being a CIA officer. The best parts about being an undercover intelligence operative is that nobody knows you're an intelligence operative. You literally control the world around you. Nobody even notices you. You can get in, execute your secret mission, and get out, and nobody even knows you were there. That is so much more pragmatic and useful than any of the stuff that you see happen on stage or screen when it comes to spies and spy novels and spy media. So really, to answer your question in as short a way as possible, the way that you start your journey to becoming an intelligence officer is you start with a ruthless focus on practical, pragmatic decision-making. And for me, as a kid, that was kind of forced upon me. My father died before I was born. I was raised by a single mom who was the first generation of American citizens who got to the United States illegally. And she didn't have a college education. Like, I was born in very practical situations. My mom had to figure out how to be a single mom, raising a child, in a different culture, And that was where I grew up. So I was feeding myself breakfast and watching Saturday morning cartoons, dressing myself for public school by the time I was 6 years old. And that's where the roots were kind of laid.
So, and obviously the government has their ways of detecting certain, I mean, oh my gosh, it's also cheesy. I'm picturing Liam Neeson in Taken saying, I have a very specific set of personality traits or whatever he says. But there's some way that the government can like identify character traits or aptitudes or something. And then I assume they have a filtering mechanism, which anyway, we'll get into that. But actually I wanna, and we may jump around here. It's how my brain works, but I love what you said about how, you know, espionage skills or spy skills or, you know, whatever the labels are, they're like so much more practical. Like in the movies, it's like, well, I know how to, you know, evade at high speed car chases, or I know how to use these like crazy technical gadgets to turn my pen into a boomerang or like whatever. But you're like, no, it's actually like a lot more sort of like almost pedestrian, the things that actually, because like, using a pen as a boomerang isn't a very good way to stay undercover, but like preparing local cuisine in a way that looks like you've done it a million times, that is actually more useful than like the glamorous stuff, right?
Sort of. So let's use your pen example, right? So, and okay, we'll make this a little bit entertaining because that's what's going to keep people's attention, right? There are essentially five places on the human body where you can stab somebody with a pedestrian pen and they will die within 30 seconds to 2 minutes, right? So, and we are trained in what those five spots are. And we are trained on how to use them. We're even trained on how to identify the right kind of pen to use, right? Whether you use something like a Bic pen that you can buy in a set of 25, that is a different kind of plastic, a different kind of tensile strength than a tactical pen or a steel pen or a metal pen that you might buy from a retail outlet, you know, in the survival space or tactical space. Regardless, when you're choosing an instrument that you might use to do someone harm, you always have to consider how that instrument might be traced back to you, whether that's through fingerprints or whether that's through some kind of sales code or some sort of registration ID, right? Because if you're going to be undercover, the perfect instrument to defend yourself with is an instrument where you use it for some sort of activity that could be considered criminal, and then you dispose of that item and it can't be traced back to you. So, you know, Bic pen number 25 in the box of 50 is the perfect kind of tool, where registration number 24612, tactical pen that was purchased in this specific shop in this specific city on this specific date, is less ideal. But here's the practical piece of it. Why the hell would you teach someone how to kill another person with a pen without first teaching them everything else about how to avoid the situation where they might have to kill somebody with a pen? And that's what people don't understand. And that's what media gets wrong. Liam Neeson has a very specific set of skills in the movie Taken. Yes, it's a fantastic line. It's super entertaining. But what's even more interesting and even more valuable is that he has dozens of other less specific skills that he was trained to use so that he never had to turn to that last set of specific skills. So we learn how to hurt people. We learn how to steal. We learn how to break in and break out of locations. We learn all of those skills only after we first learn how to master the skills that make it so we shouldn't ever have to use those final sets of skills, right? Those are all the just-in-case skills. If you're really good at what you do, if you're a really good covert undercover operative, you will never have to pull a gun. You will never have to hurt a person. You will never have to steal by breaking and entering, because you will have been so skilled in the other techniques that the people literally open their doors to you. They give you the thing that you want. They forget that you're even there. That's how you really master the practical set of espionage skills.
So to sort of skip to the, not the ending, but like the present, you're obviously now, you're no longer in the CIA. You have a platform called Everyday Spy. You're, as I understand it, you're really trying to download a lot of the especially practical side of these skills and share them and educate civilians, right? You just educate the rest of the world about the stuff. Yeah, most people, it's not terribly useful to know how to kill a person with a Bic pen, but it's incredibly useful to know how to navigate relationships and maintain calm and be emotionally regulated and be a good negotiator and control other people's perception. And I mean, that's the concept of everyday spy, is that like spy skills are great for everyday people too, right?
Exactly right. And here's why, because the most dangerous part of being a spy is actually everyday life. Because there's things that you don't even think about, right, Jeff? When you go out and you live a standard 24-hour day, there's over 100 instances where you don't even realize you are using your identity and you are leaving a breadcrumb trail behind you that is traceable, trackable, and potentially could be leveraged for harm of you, your family, or your business, right? Every time you pull out your credit card, every time you step into your own vehicle that has a license plate on the backside of that vehicle, every time you use your cell phone, every time you type in a location to GPS, every time you accept cookies on a website, there's a dozen things that you're doing without even thinking about it, right? When you click yes to allow an app to access your contact list, these are all touch points that identify Jeff Lerner, what we call the real person, right? Your true identifiable information. They connect you with a larger organization or a larger group, a larger organism that can potentially be reverse engineered to do you harm. When you are an undercover operative, the identity that you adopt is not your real identity. So now when your alias identity plugs into that larger organism, it is very traceable. It's very, very trackable back to what you claim to be versus what you actually are. So if Jeff Lerner is an alias as Jacob Trust, and Jacob Trust calls somebody who's on Jeff Lerner's contact list, you've just connected Jeff with Jacob. And now all of a sudden, both Jeff and Jacob are at risk of being identified for being the same person. So all those daily activities, from using your credit card to signing a receipt to, you know, turning when somebody calls out the name Jeff or Jacob in the hallway, all of those little everyday activities become very dangerous for an actual professional covert intelligence operative. So the thing that we're trained the most to control and anticipate are the challenges of everyday life. How to maintain control in a relationship so that somebody doesn't take control of you through a relationship, whether that's a sales relationship, a personal relationship, whether that's a professional relationship, because one of the ways that you can be compromised, whether it's compromising secrets, compromising information, or simply sacrificing your own energy, time, and money, one of the fastest ways you can become compromised is through a relationship of some sort, whether it's a relationship because somebody else is picking your kids up from school and you trust them to pick up your kids, or whether it's a relationship because, you know, you're paying somebody X number of dollars and you signed a contract. Every time you engage with another human being, you run a risk of being compromised. And that's the bigger risk to us than, let's say, kidnapping or, you know, some sort of hostile entry into your home. Those things could happen, but the probability is much lower than the probability of another human being trying to compromise you through some sort of relationship or some sort of compromising conversation.
So it seems like, yeah, it's interesting. Like the number one, forgive me, that's the marketer in me. I'm always trying to turn things into a claim, like the number one skill, all right? Like the top three must-haves. But it seems,
let's make a listicle, man. Yeah. Top five, listicle.
But well, let's start with the first, because in a way, based on what you just said, it seems like the number one skill of a spy is to be underestimatable.
Yes. They
don't see you coming, because it's a lot easier to just not have people look into the 9,000 data points than to make sure you've perfectly secured all 9,000 of the data points.
Bingo.
Based on 90 days of doing 100 things a day, right? And so I'm thinking like Sun Tzu, Art of War, like to be underestimatable, like to have them not see you coming. That is not a uniquely valuable skill to spies. That's like the number one way to have your way in life is you stay in command by getting resources to ignore you until it's your time of your choosing.
But here's what's funny about that, Jeff. You can say that rationally right now, but that's not the way people live. Right. People don't live by that truth. Because culturally, we've been conditioned to believe that we have to demand attention at all times. Yeah. We have to be noteworthy. We have to be interesting. We have to be front and center, right? And you've got all these sayings that back it up, right? The greasy wheel is the one that gets the, or the squeaky wheel gets the grease, right? Like, you've got all these ideas that are permeating through our culture that tell us you have to constantly be noteworthy and relevant, or else you are irrelevant. It's what we believe is the absolute antithesis of what is accurate and true, but it's also the antithesis of what we will land on using our own logical, rational thought process. Because you and I both get it, and everybody listening gets it too. Somehow they simultaneously understand that the real power in life comes from being anonymous. But we're doing everything in our power to not be anonymous day to day. We're trying to get our boss's attention. We're trying to post our life on social media. We're trying to get likes and friend requests and thumbs ups. We want to make other people happy. We're doing the opposite of what we already know we should be doing. A big part of what spies are trained to do is simply understand the rational, logical side of how human beings think, and then use the fact that they don't, like, abuse or manipulate the fact that human beings don't use their rational brain. They use their emotional brain to make decisions that they then later rationalize.
Yeah, it's ironic, you know, two guys here that are, you know, internet personalities at some level, right? And talking about the power of anonymity. But I think it's like, you know, I'm a former professional jazz musician. And so I think for me, where I develop this keen sense of, call it dichotomy, is like, as a jazz musician or any type of performing artist, you have a certain relatively small period, like windows of your life, like maybe a 4-hour gig on a Friday night, where it's all about being highly visible in your craft. But the 95% in music, we call it woodshedding. You go lock yourself in an 8x8 practice room, you know, windowless box, and you just spend hours in there doing work that nobody ever sees. And that's when your craft is forged. And so, you know, now I say, let's say to kind of map that analogy to the modern success model, where it's all like hyper visual and hyperbolic, like exaggerated and visual and graphically intensified via social media. I think for young people, or not young people, but people that are young in their success journey, let's say, people that are like, I want to make a change and I'm not where I want to be, they go to these mediums and they see this image, and there's a tendency, it's kind of like the spy thing, right? Like, if we think that being a spy consists of the very tiny percentage that gets dramatized in movies, we think that being successful consists of the very tiny percentage that gets dramatized through social media. But it's the 95% in the woodshed, or to your point, in micromanaging the 100 different touch points a day to not be detected, or for the average person to be underestimated because, yeah, maybe they see you as like a funny guy that can crack a joke, but they don't also realize that you're like a brilliant practitioner of a highly technical skill. And the one guy that does realize that you have that ability is the person that can give you a 7-figure-a-year consulting job or something. Like, it's managing optics and relationships. Exactly. Is like the key to life.
It is. It's for sure, it's the key to success.
Yeah.
Whether or not you want to say it's the key to life, it is absolutely the key to success. And I love that you used two words. I love that you talked about woodshedding, and I love that you talked about your trade, because I want to take this back to the very beginning of our conversation, where you talked about how you were learning about tradecraft, right? Tradecraft is the terminology that CIA officers and undercover operatives around the world use to describe the craft of espionage. And espionage is really, the term espionage really just means the illegal stealing of secrets. That is what espionage is. In no place in the world is espionage legal. The only reason that CIA operatives can live and operate in the United States conducting espionage is because of a very specific carve out in US law that makes it so that trained government agents supporting national security priorities can execute espionage around the world on behalf of the United States. That doesn't mean that when you conduct espionage on behalf of the United States in whatever, name the country, Turkey, Canada, you know, whatever, China, that doesn't mean that you're safe from their legal system,
right?
But you are safe from the American legal system, whereas American corporations conducting espionage are not safe, right? So espionage is the craft of stealing secrets. Hmm. The trade that we are in is a trade of national security. So our woodshed, where we practice our craft, just like you as a jazz musician practiced your craft in a box with no windows, we also practice our craft in a box with no windows. But the thing that we're practicing is really about how to manage and manipulate social relationships and our own ways of thinking, so that when we are in the field performing, we don't make mistakes. Just like when you're on stage performing, you don't want to make mistakes. The thing that I discovered in 2017, when I was, you know, building this concept of Everyday Spy, the thing I discovered is that when you lock yourself into a woodshed to practice and you only come out for performances, the people who appreciate you only appreciate the performance. They don't appreciate the work that you had to do to make the performance happen. So when I launched Everyday Spy in 2019, I made a commitment to open not my stage, but to open my woodshed.
Yeah.
So the reason I think that I've had the success I've had, and I have no idea where my success is going or how great it will be or if it's all going to collapse tomorrow. What I've done is I've just opened my woodshed. So when you go to my YouTube channel, when you listen to my podcast, when you look at my website, when you Google my name, you see all sorts of horrible mistakes, bad pictures, typos. You see all the crap that happens in the woodshed.
Yeah.
And then you also see those moments on stage where my performance went well. And what I did is I wanted to share that with everybody to show that I may fail or I may succeed, but either way, I'm going to open it up for everyone to see it happen. And for me, that has been the mission to continue moving forward. I'm so transparent about my successes and failures that I'm hoping it's a breath of fresh air in comparison to what we see in media, which is just the highlight reel of everybody else's life.
So, yeah, I appreciate that. And I definitely detect that in looking at your content. And I will say I try to be the same for people pursuing entrepreneurial success. I mean, I write in my book, I failed at 11 businesses. I ended up $500,000 in debt and evicted and divorced and depressed and whatever. But it's, you know, for better or for worse, here I am. And that's the life. But anyway, this is about you, not me. So I'm curious. One of the moments I listened to your interview with Lex Fridman, and I liked when you guys got into talking about the difference between you were talking about method acting, spy, you know, we'll call it spy acting or spy non-acting, as the case may be. There's like a different way to kind of get there. And then he was talking about authenticity and kind of the unified integrated life that isn't, you know, factionalized in different personas and whatnot. So I'm curious, because I think I can totally, like, it's very obvious and intuitive how these skills of like emotional regulation, staying in the logical place of the brain and not downgrading into the cerebellum and, you know, thinking like most people do, and certainly social intelligence, managing relationships, maintaining control through communication, conversational technique, like all of that, it's extremely obvious how that would benefit a person in life. The difference, and I'm curious how you sort of reconciled this or navigate how you navigate this now, is that you guys are in your old life, you were using all that to create a false reality. In call it real life, there's like probably this, at some level, almost an elevated level of art, which is to use all that, not to create a false reality, but to create almost like an intensified real reality, like a real reality in which you have more control than the average person inhabiting a real reality. So I'm curious. Yeah, connect those dots for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate what you're getting at here. So what you were talking about previously when it comes to, you know, integrated thinking and the conversation I was having with Lex when it comes to how most people kind of try to create an authentic life versus what a spy does when we try to create a compartmentalized life. That's the word we use. We compartmentalize different elements of our operations, different elements of our alias personas, as well as our genuine real personas. We compartmentalize them so that we can essentially control and insulate one from being a danger or a distraction from the other. Whereas what the average person tries to do is they try to find a way to integrate everything together. And in that process of integrating everything together, what ends up happening for a lot of people is we become overwhelmed. We become emotionally compromised, and we become overwhelmed because we're trying to do everything instead of trying to do just one or two things. So what we've turned into, or what I have done in my efforts to try to share the skills that CIA gave me and to communicate them and translate them into everyday practical, tangible methodologies, is I've had to share how we compartmentalize and why we compartmentalize, but I've also had to explain the psychological and cognitive benefits of doing such. And, you know, just like any teacher will tell you, when you teach other people how to do what you know, you start to learn it better and you start to see different ways to connect it and you start to understand it and exercise it and practice it at a higher level. So I've really gained a ton of value for myself in trying to find the way to explain, teach, and justify these practices to others. And one of the ways that we've learned to do it ourselves is, you know, we have to be very transparent. I have to be very transparent. My wife has to be very transparent. My wife is much more uncomfortable with the level of transparency that we have to share with the world in order to communicate our mission and achieve our goals, and our goals being to execute on our mission of breaking barriers with spy skills and spy education for everyday people. So the way that we've kind of learned to adapt our compartmentalization model is that most 95% of what we do about 72 hours delayed. So people who intend to do us harm, and there are plenty of people out there who want to do everyone harm. They want to tear down your success. They want to question your authority. They want to do you physical harm, whatever else it might be. We generally try to stay 72 hours behind whatever it is that we are publishing. So if you see me on social media, the picture that you see me in is 72 hours old, right? When I do interviews like this with you, this podcast is not airing today. By the right. time this podcast airs, this will not be the room that I'm in. And this nondescript room as it is a room that is going to be very difficult for people to understand and to identify anyways. So that's one of the ways that we try to insulate to keep ourselves physically safe, but we do the same kind of thing to keep our intellectual property safe. So we try to make sure that we are always publishing new content, publishing new ideas, publishing new ways and new courses, new books, new, you know, media assets or media rights. We're always trying to do that in a way where we have a head start over the competition so that we're insulated by time. Time, distance, and what's known as change in direction, these are two different, or these are three different ideas that are repeated, they're foundational within espionage and tradecraft. Changing direction means people think you're going left, but then you're actually turned right before they realize it. Time means that the more time you have under your control, the more advantage you have over your opponents. And distance means that the farther the distance that you cover in a period of time, the more difficult it is for your adversary to be able to catch up and find you, especially if you're also changing direction. So we've just taken these three concepts, these time, distance, and change of direction, and we've applied them to our physical life to protect our family, and we've applied them to our business and our IP to protect what we're building professionally and in our career.
That's really interesting. I see why it's sort of like, okay, what would be the relevance of, you know, espionage work to like a Fortune 100 company? But you get into concepts like that and you're like, I see, strategic preserving competitive advantage and so forth. So I want to drill down to, or kind of stay on this authenticity question. So one of the sort of dialectical tensions in my life and my work is, like, just a little quick context. I run an education platform that has a very large number, upwards of 100 a day, of students coming in that are like, I want to change direction in my life. And that requires, I mean, for most people, it's like, I need a new relationship with money. Either I make more of it or I have some new way to get it. Like I'm currently clocking into the warehouse at Amazon 12 hours a day. And instead I want to be able to sit at home on a laptop to get money, right? It's not always, I need to make a bunch more. It's just, I want to be able to do something different to get it. And so we're an entrepreneurial education platform, but what are, I think our unique vantage point on that, it makes us different from the rest of the online business education in the world is like, you come into our world and immediately we say, it's not about the business. It's not about the skills. It's not about the marketing. It's not about the sales funnels. It's about the person. It's about you. And it's really a personal development approach to different professional and personal and physical. Those are, we call those the three P's, outcomes. And so I say all that, that's just a little bit of context. One of the main concepts that we hone in on for people, the term I use is a success character, which you could almost think of it as like the Freudian ego ideal, right? It's like this projected visualization of self based on all my idealized qualities. It's the version of me. It's like Clark Kent visualizing himself as Superman, right? It's the version of me that is most likely to actually go out into the world and accomplish my goals and realize my dreams and be the best provider for my family and be the best husband or wife for my spouse or whatever. And so then how to create a state of mind almost like a that you can step into, again, like the Superman, like Clark Kent stepping into the phone booth, where every day as you kind of put your armor on to go out into the world and make your dreams come true, it's that version of you that's showing up. And so the dialectical tension is like, you want that, you don't want that version of you to be someone that you're not. You want that version of you to be an intensification of the best of what you truly are and a diminution of your weaknesses, let's say, right? So it's still Jeff. For me, it's still Jeff. It's just like this optimized version of Jeff that can go do the thing. And so you see the concept. So it's like, how could we use what spies learn to do to become someone else? How could we use to become the best of what we truly are? So we sort of reconcile that tension that Lex was pointing out. Hey there, real quick. I just wanted to let you know, I have been concentrating a lot lately on providing tons of value to my text message community. This could be random thoughts. This could be letting you be the first to know about an event I'm planning or a special I'm running or a free training I'm hosting. Anyway, just shoot me a text to get subscribed. The number is 702-996-3926. Thanks so much. Let's get back to the podcast.
So there's two ways that immediately jump to mind. And I really like this concept that you have of essentially creating a target persona. That's yeah. How I would translate what you're talking about, right? So another thing the media gets wrong, when spies don an alias, the alias is really only between 5% and 10% different than who you really are. It's a small change. And there's all sorts of tradecraft reasons why we only make a small change. But the bottom line is you're not transforming yourself 80%. You're not becoming a completely different person. You're not turning 180 degrees and going in the opposite direction of who you really are. You're really only changing about 7%, 8%, 10% of what your true life persona actually is. So if I myself am a middle manager at CIA with 12 years of experience and 2 college degrees, then when I don an alias, guess what I'm probably going to be? A mid-level manager with 2 degrees who's have 12 years of experience on the job. I just might change the name of the job. I might go from being Andrew Bustamante to being, you know, Antonio Joseph, something like that, right? I'm going to keep at least one of my initials so that, you know, whenever I have to write my signature, even if I make a mistake and I start signing my true name, I can quickly correct that mistake. You're always building in a room for what we call predictable error. There's always going to be predictable error. So what you want to do is build your operation to make space for predictable error. So when I hear you talk about coaching and driving and guiding and teaching people to step into a persona, the first thing I would say is if they think they have to change most of who they are, think again. Because professionally, what the most elite operatives in the world do is we only change 10%, right? At most. And the less that you can change, the better off you are, because it gives you all the advantages of who you are and all of your real experience, your real knowledge, your real network, your real memories. You can call upon all of those when you keep things close to true. When you change everything, all of a sudden you have to, ignore your memories, ignore your experience, because it doesn't make any sense for someone who's been a painter in Italy for the last 25 years. It makes no sense when that person starts telling a story about how they were at, you know, in New York for New Year's Eve 2 years ago. They have to find a way to explain why they were in New York, but they haven't been out of Italy for the last 25 years. So, you know, stepping to that persona means knowing that, taking the majority of who you are with you and using it to your advantage. The second thing that we do in intelligence is we always recognize that if you're focused on where you're going, you're only focused on half of what you need to know. Consider a person who's trying to navigate through the forest, right? They have a compass and they know where they are because of the compass. They know what direction they're going. They know where they want to go, but there's still a third piece that they need in order to achieve their true destination. They have to also know where they started, because to get where you're going, you have to know where you started from and you have to know where you currently are. If any of those three pieces are missing, the chances of you getting lost are much, much higher, right? If anybody's been a Boy Scout, or if anybody's been, you know, in a position where they've had to use land navigation, when you're literally just using a compass and a destination, that's called dead reckoning. And dead reckoning is prone to massive errors and huge, you know, losses of time and energy and effort, because you're kind of going in like a fishtail towards your direction. Whereas when you know your start point and you know your end point, and you know where you are, you have a straight line. It's the most efficient way of getting to where you're going. So one of the things that we constantly do in espionage is we refer back to where we started as children, where we started as students, where we started in our intelligence profession. And we always measure our success against where we started. Don't measure your success against where you're going, because guess what? Where you're going changes. It changes with technology, it changes with age, it changes with life experience, and especially in intelligence operations, when policymakers dictate what your intelligence priorities are, you might spend 2 years chasing an Iranian nuclear scientist only to find out that now the United States isn't interested in that. They're interested in some new terrorist group that's causing, you know, that's wreaking havoc in Iraq. And now you have to change. So if you're measuring your success against what you've been pursuing for the last 2 years, you will feel like a failure. What you need to do is measure your success against where you started from before you can actually see your progress. Very similar to being on a race course. If you're racing a marathon, if you're racing a 3-mile turkey trot, if you only measure where you are against the finish line, you're always going to be depressed. But if you measure where you are against where you started, you see real gains and real accomplishments.
Hence Tony Robbins' proverbial statement that progress is happiness. Okay, so this is really interesting. So first of all, I love the idea of it doesn't take much to be a different enough variation. And I'll go ahead and throw out that I think we're only 1% different genetically than chimpanzees. Like, it really doesn't take much. But that's awesome. I remember when I was in college and I wanted to take a foreign language and I spoke English and Spanish, and they said, oh, you should take Italian or French. Because they're the most like the combination of English and Spanish. Whereas if you go take Russian, it's like a whole lot more you got to remember and learn new stuff, and you're more apt to make mistakes, right? For mapping this, and I'm thinking with the audience in mind, so many of the listeners to the show, they're, you know, here to unlock their potential vis-a-vis an entrepreneurial pivot in their lives. A lot of the audience comes from Entre, my education platform. And so if you're like listening to this, I think that the paradigm that I'm seeing in my mind is how to map this to this creation of this version of yourself, because most of the audience here is not going to go become a professional spy, but they are trying to go become a professionally expanded version of self via making more money, making a bigger impact, leading a movement, building a business, whatever. And so I feel like these concepts map really well. Change as little as possible. So, and that speaks to the idea that you want this version of yourself to be the true version of yourself. You're not trying to create someone different. And most people, if you do like a character trait analysis, there's usually only a few things. Well, there's technically always in any set of variables, one variable is going to be the most constrained of all the variables. So for like the average person, if you say, okay, map all their character traits, let's say one of them is, I'm really scared of public speaking. That one variable could be responsible for like 90, let's say that's one of 20 variables. So it's only 5% of the variables, but it could represent 90% of the limitations that you're placing on yourself. So instead of focusing on 20 things to change, just visualize a success character that just has that one that's expanded. And you open up a whole new world of possibilities.
Right. I would even argue, accept the restriction for what it is.
Okay.
And instead of investing a massive amount of energy and effort and resources into changing the constraint, instead take all those same invested resources and put them into something where you're naturally strong.
Okay.
Right? We have another concept in espionage where we don't try to fix our weaknesses. Mm-hmm. We try to improve our strengths. Because as you get better at your strengths, guess what happens to your weaknesses? They also naturally improve. It's a question of return on investment, or a question of how you distribute limited resources. Cognitively and practically, distributing your resources into the areas where they have the highest return on investment is a better decision than investing your resources into a quotient with a lower return on investment. So if you're really good at one-on-one conversations, but you're really bad at public speaking, it might make more sense to double down on one-on-one interactions instead of the hours and time and investment and money that would go into taking public speaking courses and tormenting yourself on these little stages. And every step of the way, you're beating yourself up. Whereas if you take the same resources and you put them into one-on-one conversations, you might have real success in business.
Yeah, that's a great point. You're right, because to try to improve a weakness would be to make yourself unlike yourself to a greater degree than to increase an already naturally present strength. That person's going to be more like the raw person than the other. So I love that insight. So that actually, you know, what that reminds me of, I don't know if you've studied positive psychology in the work of Martin Seligman, but in the late 20th, early 21st century, Martin Seligman at University of Pennsylvania basically said, hey, all of psychology is focused on people's weaknesses, deficiencies, sicknesses, neuroses, and so forth. And even the diagnostic and statistical manual, you go through it and it's like, it's just this giant tome of all the things that can be wrong with people mentally. He's like, what if we created a version of psychology that focused on what's right with people and amplifying those? And he rewrote the DSM to be called the CSV, Characters, Strengths, and Virtues. And you go through it and it's like, oh, that, I have that, I have that, only they're good things. And then it's a school of psychology that teaches you to lean into those traits. And it's got some pretty, and that sounds a little bit woo-woo, but it's got like major clinical bona fides of far superior validated outcomes than always everybody just focusing on what's wrong with them. So that's really interesting. So then let's get like really brass tacks. Actually, let's get brass tacks. But before that, let's back up. I feel like there's still a little bit of biography missing, and I'm keeping an eye on the time because I want to get as much from you as I can. Let me ask. Like you mentioned that as a little kid, you're sort of practically oriented, and that was where this bed of skills or traits were developed. But like, what do you think particularly suited you? Because there's a lot of latchkey kids that take care of themselves. What do you think particularly suited you for this work? And then once you got into the work, as much as you can share, I'm curious, what were those traits that you found in yourself that you needed to lean into or amplify in order to become the best spy you possibly could?
So, you know, this is a great question for a number of reasons. But the what I think most latchkey kids will understand and appreciate that is critical to answering this question is that CIA puts you through between a 9 and 18 month recruitment process. And that recruitment process isn't so that they can find the best of the best. That's something that Hollywood makes you believe. They're not looking for the best of the best. They're not looking for the person who is optimized and self-sufficient and confident and, you know, the person who can do anything. That's not who CIA is looking for. They're looking for somebody who is inherently dependent on external validation and somebody who takes specific orders and will put will value executing the order above protecting themselves, right? So the reason it takes 9 to 18 months of vetting is to find the exact right combination of person who will essentially be brought into an environment where they will be given secrets. They will be given national security secrets, and they will be trained how to execute crimes without being caught. Before you invest in that kind of person, you need to go through a very robust HR process to right. bring them in. And the person that you want is somebody who's incredibly loyal, very predictable, and who you have intense leverage over, psychological leverage over.
And that's so, where the external validation piece comes in, that they're used exactly. to essentially being controlled by someone or something else.
They need it. They want it. They seek it out, right? And that's what happened to me as a child and growing up as a teenager. I mean, every decision I made was a decision made through the lens of, would mom and dad approve, right? My mother and my stepfather, would they approve? Would grandma approve? Does it make me look good to girls? Does it make me look good to my teachers? Will my principal support me? That was how all of my decisions were made. And I had great success making decisions through those lenses, just like I'm guessing most of the people that probably listen to you, right? We have had success doing what other people tell us to do. And because every time you have success doing what you're told, it conditions you to double down and believe that you should do what you're told. The people who grow up independent, the people who truly grow up as like rogues, they've had the opposite experience, where when they do what they're told, they get hurt. So then they start rebelling against doing what they're told. The rest of us feel like we want to rebel, but ultimately we do what we're told to do. So that's how CIA finds us. And once they bring us into that institution, now they have recruited the most conditioned, controllable population possible. And then they start to train us and indoctrinate us into more of that control. The place where it all kind of came apart for me when I saw the wizard behind the curtain was when I had my first child. My wife and I found out that we were pregnant. We were on a mission together, undercover, operating overseas, and we were pregnant. And my wife, was an amazing officer. She's still an amazing woman, but she came out with her pregnancy test crying. And she was crying because she was like, she was telling me, like, this is such an inconvenient time, right? We're doing such important work. What if they take us off the mission? What if we lose the opportunity to execute this, you know, this objective? She was so focused on what we were losing without recognizing what we were gaining. And in being the third person, being the person not carrying the child, being the person not holding the pregnancy test, it all dawned on me instantaneously. And I was like, oh my gosh, we are literally putting national security and our jobs ahead of this life that we get the privilege to raise. So that was the beginning of the end for me. From that point, the walls of Jericho started falling down, and I started seeing it for what it really was. I was able to introduce my wife to the thought process, and she started to see it for what it really was. And CIA kept taking certain actions with us that further showed us that our theory was true. So when we decided to leave CIA in 2014, a big part of that was because we realized that we had a choice to control our own outcomes using the skills that CIA had given us, rather than believing that CIA was thinking in our best interests, because they weren't. We were specifically recruited so that our organization could make us do things that were not in our best interest.
So it's interesting. You answered the question that I thought to ask, but didn't. When you initially set up what they're looking for, their recruiting parameters, I thought, so if I'm hearing you right, the question was something to the effect of, it sounds like there's a point at which a human could be sufficiently healed and psychologically well-adjusted that they were no longer fit for service.
Correct.
And it makes perfect sense that a moment that could, you know, change can happen in a moment. Often it takes a lot of time, but having your first child, that's the kind of road to Damascus awakening thing that can happen to a person that, and you, like you said, it made you like unfit for service because no longer were you willing to be, in psychology, they call it an external locus of control. Your locus of control moved inward into your family unit at that point. That's right. So interesting. And I'm curious, do you feel like what you just said, you said that specifically around being recruited into the CIA for covert operations. But it feels like what you're saying probably is relatively true across being fit for government service of any type. I mean, the government relies on people that are kind of like you described.
Companies, man, this is the thing. This applies across the board to government or public or private sector jobs, right? If you're a salesperson, guess what your company wants you to do? They want you to sell. Do they really care if your mother is dying of cancer? No. They gave you a decent health plan and they gave you certain benefits so that it can, to you, it seems like they're taking care of you when you have this challenge in your life. But they'll only take care of you as long as you keep selling.
Right.
If you're a program manager, the same thing applies. If you're a warehouse technician, the same thing applies. Your company does not care about you as much as you care about yourself. Their whole job is to create a benefits package and a salary package and give you the kind of quality of life in the business that makes you always second guess whether or not you should leave that job. And that restricts your freedom in a way that entrepreneurialism does not. Because when you are an entrepreneur, you have control over your life. You want to step away from the business for 7, 12, 15, 31, 85 days? You can. You want to focus on your mother and her dying weeks? You can. You want to take care of your wife in the first few months after she has a child? You can. And you don't have to ask anyone permission, right? That is the internal locus of control that you're talking about, Jeff. And that is what I have seen is life-changing about stepping away from an organization that is not serving your best interests and creating an organization that does.
Well, I'd like to thank you for saying what you just said. This message is proudly brought to you by Entre Institute, where Andrew Bustamante has just given one of the best statements I've ever heard of why people should embrace entrepreneurialism. Is there an inherent contradiction over time in the workings of the CIA? And I would, let's just focus on that, where by teaching you how these skills that allow you to control relationships, in effect, they're giving you the ability to retake control in your life. Do those skills end up forcing their own turnover as spies wake up one day and go, wait, I can control relationships. I should control my relationship with my employer. And given that they're trying to control me, that doesn't work anymore. I'm going to go into the private sector.
Unfortunately, it does not. Because unless you have that watershed moment, and everybody's watershed moment is different. For me, it was my first child, and that goes back to the fact that I grew up fatherless, right? Mm. So when I had the chance to become a father, watershed moment for me. So for the vast majority of CIA officers, those watershed moments, either they come and they're not taken advantage of, or they never come. And you see that in the attrition rate that happens generally at CIA. They have a very low attrition rate traditionally. What CIA has been struggling with for the last 5 years is that their attrition rate has spiked. Because the modern day generation of adult has much more ambition and much less patience and much less loyalty to an organization than what used to exist. And that's something that's affecting companies, you know, worldwide or nationwide right now. So you are correct that there should be a moment where you wake up and realize all the ways I'm being manipulated are things that I can do in return. I can take control over my boss just like my boss is trying to control me. That is a big part of what Everyday Spy is there to do, teach people how to turn that storyline around. But it still takes the individual to have that watershed moment and to invest in their own time, resources, and energy to learn those skills.
So based on my commitment to you to get us out of here pretty close to on time, I'm going to suppress my desire to ask you 800 more questions and use that opening of, you said that's what Everyday Spy does. So talk to us a little bit more about your business, about your work, about what the audience can go get and learn from you and how to find you.
Absolutely. I mean, I appreciate that. My mission with my business is very simple. I want to use spy education to break barriers for everyone willing to learn. That's it. If you're not willing to learn, or if you don't want to use spy education to break your barrier, that's fine. If you don't even think you have a barrier to break, then you're not part of my target audience, right? I am trying to serve the people I can serve at the highest level. So if you want to learn more about how we do that, you can visit my website, everydayspy.com. You can listen to any one of our podcast channel mediums. We have a podcast on YouTube. We have a podcast on all of your favorite audio podcast platforms. And then, of course, you can follow me on social media at Everyday Spy. in any direction you go, we're going to feed you to the maximum ability that we can and give you the skills that you need to break those barriers of success.
Man, that sounds so, so cool and interesting. I will be digging deeper into it myself. Okay, folks, that's it. Our time with Andrew is up. Andrew, thanks for being a guest, man. This has been a lot of fun.
My pleasure, Jeff. And I'll come back anytime, man. It was a pleasure talking to you.
I appreciate that. And of course, to all you viewers and listeners out there, what I tell you every time, you're the best part of this show. Even when Andrew's on, you're the best part of this show. You're why I do what I do every single day. And I'm so glad we got this time together. Catch you next time.
Hey, it's Jeff here. If you liked this episode of Unlock Your Potential, it would mean so much if you would like and share the episode on whatever platform you're listening or viewing on. And if you really like what we're doing here and you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review. There is so much work that goes into these episodes, and you leaving a positive review lets us know that that work is reaching people, and especially it helps us reach other people. Your review could be the reason that someone else decides to tune in, check out this podcast, and unlock their potential and ultimately level up the quality of their life. So thank you so much for your support and for listening, and especially if you like or share or leave a review. Thank you for helping us spread the word, and thank you for unlocking your potential to go make the world and your world a better place.